Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a shocking and shameful example of the priorities of the House Republicans, who have slipped legislation into the National Defense Authorization Act at the behest of the banking lobby that would block protection for American servicemen and their families from predatory payday lenders. Robert Weissman, the president of Public Citizen, joins us to discuss how efforts to shield military families from short-term high-interest loans, where a year-long $2,600 loan costs $3,967 to pay back and a six-month $485 loan costs $1,428 to pay off, have been stalled before the House Armed Services Committee. Then, following an impassioned speech today by Hillary Clinton in her first major policy address, where she called for an end to the era of mass incarceration, saying, "From Ferguson to Staten Island to Baltimore, the patterns have become unmistakable and undeniable." We will speak with Amy Dillard, a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. She recently served on a Baltimore commission to examine the death of a prisoner in police custody, and we will discuss the payouts the cash-strapped city has made to more than 100 people in court judgments and settlements over the past 4 years for civil rights violations and police brutality. Then finally, we will look into the case of the only person so far to be punished for the Bush-Cheney CIA torture regime, Obama's nominee for the Army's General Counsel, Alyssa Starczak, whose nomination is being held up as payback for doing her job of oversight for the public as the lead investigator on the torture report. Ali Watkins, who covers national security and foreign policy for The Huffington Post, joins us to discuss her latest article at The Huffington Post, "Someone is Finally Paying the Price for the CIA Torture Report." And joining us now is Robert Weissman, who is the president of Public Citizen and an expert on economic, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy. He has written extensively on corporate accountability, access to medicines, corporate influence over the political process, the World Trade Organization, and regulations of the financial markets. His top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation, and campaign finance reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Weissman.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
And we're just learning today that the House Armed Services Committee is looking into the National Defense Authorization Act, and apparently at the behest of the banking lobby, Republican lawmakers have slipped in a deregulation item that would block efforts to protect American military families from predatory payday lenders. I mean, that just strikes me as the most shameful, hypocritical thing. I mean, it's pretty hard to come up with examples of more flagrant hypocrisy, because all of these guys and girls that you see up there expounding in these hearings, they're always talking about how much we care for the troops and nothing is good enough for our fighting men and women. What in God's name are they getting away with here?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is astounding, even by the standards of Washington, D.C., and it's probably worse than most people who aren't connected to the military would realize at first blush. That's because the predatory lending industries really target service men and women. About 1 in 4 service members every year are taking out some kind of short-term loans that have predatory components. And the reason is that the industries go after, you know, the service men and women, by and large, you got a pool of young people who are not financially sophisticated, who are getting access to a paycheck, and therefore you can sort of use the money they're getting to loan them more money and steal away from them the check they're getting every 2 weeks or every month or whatever it is. So you really see in military base towns just streets lined with all kinds of payday lenders and car companies with rip-off loans and on. And this problem is so severe that the Defense Department has designated it a real problem of threatening national military readiness, both because the troops who are embroiled in all these rip-off loans have their morale sapped, and instead of spending their time thinking about their jobs, they're thinking about the loans payments that they can't make, and also because defaulting on loans can interfere with their security clearance and cause problems with the process by which they would otherwise be deployed. So the Defense Department actually proposed a very strong rule to protect the troops as consumers from predatory lenders. And what the Republicans in the House are now doing is proposing a provision that would block the implementation of that rule for at least a year, so make it at least one more year for the predatory lenders to go after the troops that, as you say, they claim to love so much.
But my understanding is that General Petraeus' wife, Holly Petraeus, has taken the lead for some time, for years back, I think before her husband got into trouble. Hasn't she been the lead person in getting this protection?
Yeah, that's right. Holly Petraeus is great on this issue. She knows everything about it, extremely articulate. You have the biggest brand name on the military side working on this thing, even if it's tarnished now. And that's helped drive forward this really good rule that came out of the Defense Department, but apparently not enough to stop the House Republicans from working on behalf of the banking industry to delay the implementation of this really important set of protections for servicemen and women.
Well, so in other words, the Department of Defense and America's war heroes are up against Wells Fargo, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citigroup because they have pursued hundreds of illegal foreclosures against active duty members of the military, reaching, you know, multiple settlements with the Department of Justice over these practices. And they've had to even resort to a public relations campaign to repair their image. So my understanding is that the big Wall Street banks, they find payday lenders, even though they try and keep a distance from them, through their subsidiaries, they find them a really good profit center.
Yeah, that's right. There's been so much money made in the predatory sector that the more traditional banking industry has got itself intertwined with it. You know, just for people to understand what this means, people are taking out these short-term loans, sometimes these payday loans, can be for a few hundred dollars, but then they take out new loans to pay off the old loans, and they end up paying, 400 or 500% interest rate when you compile it all together on these short-term loans. Or you have similar kinds of ripoffs going on throughout the auto industry, or in all kinds of problems in the mortgage sector, as you're saying. So the rule that the Defense Department put forward said, look, when short-term, long-term, whatever it is, we're capping the interest rate that can be imposed on a service member at 36%. Now, that's really high compared to traditional lending rates, but 36% as regards these short-term loans, that's giving these companies a very healthy profit, but it's also helping protect the consumers, in this case these military consumers, from getting stuck in this trap where they keep borrowing more and more and paying more and more interest out of it. So very good rule out of the Defense Department, and exactly as you said, members of Congress, given the choice of siding with the troops or siding with the banks, have gone for the banks.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Weisman, who's the president of Public Citizen and an expert on economic, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibilities. His top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation and campaign finance reform. But according to a 2014 report issued by the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which I might add the banking lobby has done everything to stifle, frustrate, and kill, they have documented abuse. And here's just some examples. A military family took out a $2,600 loan, and they ended up paying back $3,966.84 over the course of a year. And another military family spent $1,428.28 to pay off a $485 6-month loan. I mean, the mafia would be embarrassed to charge that kind of interest.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And those examples, those are not outlier examples. Those are representative examples.
So how do you shame these guys and girls up there in the Congress, up there on the podiums, pontificating about how much they care for our boys and girls in uniform? I mean, is there any way to shame the shameless?
Well, it may not be so much about their personal morality, but they do care about being exposed. You know, some people might think that there was a focus on the issue of lending to service members because of exactly the kind of conversation we're having. It's like, oh my gosh, how can you not protect the troops? And so it is just sort of political positioning. But it's not that. It's actually that they are a special target of these predatory lenders. So this is an issue of far-reaching significance. It's really, really, you know, it really affects tens of thousands of people in a really vital way. And if we can, I think, bring forward the stories that you're highlighting, that I'm referencing, that the CFPB has documented, and just force into the news this story, that's exactly what we said. They have a choice between the banks and the troops, and they're going for the banks. I don't know if they'll feel any personal shame about that, but I think they can be made to feel political shame, and that does make the difference.
But my understanding, Robert Weissman, is that the banking committee is the one committee that a lot of Congress people want to get on, because they just throw money at you. And this includes Democrats as well as Republicans. And clearly, in this case, it's the Republicans who are carrying the water for the banking committee. But is that true, that this is the most sought-after slot, because it's considered, you just get showered with money, so it's, you don't have to spend. I mean, we basically, as far as I understand, and you're there in Washington, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that our legislatures have been turned into telemarketers. So if you're on the banking committee, you don't have to do so much telemarketing. They just throw money at you.
Yeah, the short answer is yes, that's right. So the banking committee has expanded dramatically because members are so eager to get on it. Exactly as you say. That's because regulated industries tend to focus their donations, their campaign donations, on members who serve on the committees that directly oversee them. So Wall Street and the banks give a disproportionate amount of their money to members of the banking committees. So, you know, it's not just that you're from New York and the banks are in your backyard. You can be, whatever. You can be based out of Kansas. But if you're on the banking committee, they will make heavy donations to you because you're on the committee that directly oversees them. So it has a direct benefit to the members in terms of their campaign fundraising. And also, as you say, exactly correct, members of Congress spend a huge amount of time raising money for their next election. And it's a little bit easier if you've got a constituency that's as deep-pocketed as Wall Street, that makes as significant contributions as Wall Street does. That's an attractive place to be. And it also, I mean, one thing to underscore also, as you say, this issue that we're talking about with this, whether or not there's going to be protections for the troops or whether they're going to continue to be ripped off by the predatory lenders, this is falling on partisan lines. The Republicans are the ones who are carrying the water for the banking industry. But the broader problem we're talking about is not a partisan one. It affects the Democrats as well, and it certainly affects the Democrats, at least many of the Democrats, on the banking committee, although there are many good members on the banking committee as well.
And Representative Tammy Duckworth, who's an Iraq war veteran who lost both of her legs flying a helicopter in Iraq, she's taking on this issue. But it, to my mind, Robert Weissman, it sort of shows a sort of pattern of these government-protected, bottom-feeding actors like payday lenders. The other example are the for-profit college industry, which is entirely operates on federal dollars, almost entirely, 99%. And they use federal dollars to advertise falsely to get veterans, to get active service members into further education, aspirants to the middle class from the minority communities. They get them absolutely saddled with a lifelong debt. And at the end of the day, they deliver a worthless diploma. And it's gotten so outrageous that now that one of the big actors in this federally financed systematic ripoff, you know, almost like a RICO statute could be used against them, they, Corinthian, have just gone under and left all these people high and dry. And my understanding is that, you know, this is entirely protected on a bipartisan basis by members of Congress, and you know, Jeb Bush is running for president. He was their keynote speaker at the recent, for the trade group that represents the for-profit college industry. So it just seems like they've really got their hooks into Washington. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, you know, what's happened over the last 30 years, maybe a little bit more now, is the over-financialization of America, which is Wall Street and the banking sector just having too big a share of the overall economy. And a part of that story has been just this crazy mushrooming growth of all these predatory industries, which, whether it's traditional lending or the for-profit education sectors you're talking about, they're really financial businesses. It's not; those are not businesses about providing education to people. The for-profit colleges; those are businesses about getting people into a lending trap and taking a lot of their money. And both the payday lenders and all the predatory lending industry and the for-profit college business has just grown at an unbelievable pace, far bigger even than this over-financialization problem. And what happens when they become big enough, they start to gain political power. And, you know, they get ignored a little bit when they're small, and the regulators may not even pay attention to them because this seemed like a peripheral problem in society, not that big a deal. Then when they become a big enough problem that the regulators ought to go after them, you know, really should be high up on their list, or Congress ought to be legislating to solve the problem, they have enough political power to defend themselves. And it's hard to defeat these kinds of industries because the appropriate regulatory solutions or the appropriate legislative solutions are a matter of life and death for the industry. Now, if we properly deal with the for-profit college industry, a huge portion of that's just going to die away because it's based entirely, as you say, on ripping off young people who are trying to get ahead, including a lot of service members. You properly regulate the payday industry, payday lending industry, it's going to massively shrink because its business model is based on ripping people off, and same on down the line. So the businesses have all the interest in the world in spending huge amounts of money and campaign contributions and lobbying and funding think tanks and doing all the kinds of things where they are able to project their political power to defend themselves, because these aren't just issues of some importance to them. They are life and death issues to these industries, and it makes it ever harder to get them under control.
Well, just in closing there, Robert Weissman, I was astounded by the House's passage of repealing the estate tax on the 1% of the 1%, the richest estates in America, because anybody, you know, family estate or husband and wife, they get about $11 million of deduction. So it only applies the estate tax now to very, very few families. And they shamelessly repealed this at the behest of the wealthiest Americans. And not only that, there's a provision that rolls over these estates in perpetuity to heirs without having to pay capital gains. So it really is a step towards American plutocracy and creating an oligarchy. And my understanding of American history is that the founding fathers saw this country as future as a meritocracy. So it gets to the heart and soul. I mean, I know you're fighting the good fight there in Washington, but do you ever wonder if there's going to be a wake-up call about the very nature of our democracy and the direction that we're heading towards plutocracy?
Yes, I do wonder about that. Although I don't think that the repeal of the estate tax is going to become law. You're right that goes back to core issues at the founding of the country, and it's a deep version of democracy. It's not just whether we have formal elections and the right to vote. It's whether we have intensely concentrated income and wealth and the ability to perpetuate concentrations of wealth over generations. In other words, do we live in a feudal society or do we live in a post-feudal society? So it is hugely important, to be sure. And we have a Congress right now that's pretty miserable on this whole set of issues and responsive both ideologically and in terms of their donor class to an extremist ideology and to the plutocracy. That said, though, I mean, I do think that people are increasingly getting mobilized, especially around money and politics issues. And as bad as things are, as many of these examples as we have to offer, I'm pretty hopeful, actually, that the public is both organizing itself and mobilizing in a different way to reinstate and reclaim our democracy, not permit a fall off into the plutocracy you're describing.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Wiseman.
Great to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Wiseman, who's the president of Public Citizen. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about payouts made by the cash-strapped city of Baltimore to settle civil rights violations and police brutality cases.
Get from out the road when he get dull, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, affest. The 10K cave or chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are double, get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he bout to change the price again. They go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, Apple's shrilling in fear. And won't stop top ill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spare here. A new meaning to sales through the roof. Guaranteed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Amy Dillard, who's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and a former public defender. She recently served on a Baltimore commission to examine the death of a prisoner in police custody. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amy Dillard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Hillary Clinton today in a public forum at Columbia University said that there's something profoundly wrong with our criminal justice system. And quoting her, she said, "From Ferguson to Staten Island to Baltimore, the patterns have become unmistakable and undeniable. Walter Scott shot in the back in Charleston, South Carolina, unarmed, in debt, terrified of spending more time in jail for child support payments he couldn't afford. Tamir Rice shot in a park in Cleveland, Ohio, unarmed and just 12 years old. Eric Garner choked to death after being stopped for selling cigarettes on the streets of our city. And now Freddie Gray, his spine nearly severed while in police custody." It sounds as though at least this candidate for president is stepping up to the plate and talking about the reality. And I take it this is a reality that you've been dealing with for some time.
It is. And I'll say that, you know, I think there are two major parts that are worth examining in what you've just quoted from Hillary Clinton. The first, maybe most substantive piece of it, is how do the police interact with citizens in their community? The second one, though, is how do the police investigate themselves when a member of the police force kills someone or commits a crime against someone of a lesser magnitude than of killing them. The first piece of that, boy, that is big and messy. And, you know, there are systemic problems, without a doubt. There are elements of police training and communication, and we could examine, you know, the role of the Supreme Court in authorizing and finding constitutional more and more interactions between the police and citizens with less and less cause. The second piece of it, though, the how do the police investigate themselves, I think is part of what has really got the spotlight right now. Or maybe people think that's the part that seems easier to address. And I think that some of the frustration in Baltimore right now, and it was present in the death of Tyrone West, which is the death in custody that I sat on the independent review panel for, certainly present with Freddie Gray, is that why is it taking so long to engage in this level of investigation? Anybody who's been, you know, in contact with the police system in any capacity knows that if one citizen shot and killed another citizen, that person would be arrested. And the investigation would be most often an investigation towards the prosecution and towards a successful prosecution. And with these police officers being investigated by their own departments, it seems like the approach is wholly different. And I think that's some of the current frustration.
And does that have something to do with the Maryland Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, which seems to protect the police at the expense of the public's right to know?
I don't think it does at all. And I'll tell you, I'm currently sitting on an ad hoc commission reviewing police practices in Fairfax, Virginia, a case of good publicity that was settled about a week ago. A police officer shot and killed a man who was standing in his own doorway. And that was in the fall of 2013. 18 months after that happened, the public still didn't know the name of the officer who shot and killed the man, much less any of the facts surrounding this investigation that was ongoing for these 18 months. It wasn't until the family filed a civil wrongful death suit and engaged in discovery surrounding that litigation that some of this information started to come out and be available to the public. County of Fairfax settled that wrongful death suit last week for nearly $3 million. We still don't have information about the investigation and the decision of whether to prosecute the officer or not. I mean, the prosecutor says that there will be a special grand jury that will meet and review the evidence in that case. But the procedure that the police department and the prosecutor's office are employing to review these cases where police officers kill a citizen are so markedly different from the procedures that everyday citizens get if they find themselves, holding a gun, having killed someone. Even in cases where, you know, there's lots of evidence that that was a killing done in self-defense, or a case that I often go back to, in my office when I was a public defender, we represented a woman who was charged with murdering her husband. She was a battered woman. It was incredibly well documented the number of times they had been in court where he was the defendant charged with physically abusing her. But when she killed her husband, she was charged with murder, and the police department investigated her and built a case to prosecute her for murder. And the fact that she had been a battered woman, or the fact that she was acting in self-defense, everyone saw that as, well, that's just something the defendant will have to raise and present to the jury and see if they believe it or not. Police officers don't seem to have that same obligation foisted on them in terms of raising and mounting their own defenses. It seems like prosecutors are doing it for them, or the police department's doing it for them. And, you know, frankly, I understand why. I mean, I think I understand that, you know, there's a presumption that somebody who's acting as a sworn law enforcement officer and has a duty to protect us, that it's reasonable to think that person has acted in a lawful way. But for the investigation to presume that for months and months and months and months without ever revealing that to the public, that's more than a little problematic.
And again, I'm speaking with Amy Dillard, who's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and a former public defender. She recently served on a Baltimore commission to examine the death of a prisoner in police custody. When I was referring to the Maryland Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, apparently efforts to make it more open and transparent have been blocked in the legislature. But what is clear from the Baltimore Sun's recent investigation into police brutality in Baltimore is that the Sun estimated that the cash-strapped city of Baltimore had spent $5.7 million on settlements and $5.8 million on legal fees since January of 2011. So in many ways, I think that's a real litmus test, isn't it? How much the citizens of the city have to pay out to compensate people for police brutality.
I mean, I think that's right. And I was reading that story in very carefully just last night. And when you start to add it up, what you start to see is that citizens are getting piecemeal satisfaction, I guess, by proxy through these civil lawsuits where the city is paying out hundreds of thousands or $1 million here and there for a number of different cases. The public might simply get more satisfaction, and it might be more appropriate satisfaction, if there were criminal investigations that looked like normal criminal investigations in these cases. They're very different standards of proof, and why the city settles a case is, you know, a separate issue from whether something could be prosecuted successfully or not. But I think that the satisfaction, or what the public yearns for, is to see that police officers aren't being treated as though they are privileged to commit crime against citizens. And, you know, if you keep everything behind closed doors, and if police officers are almost never, or as in Fairfax County, are never prosecuted a citizen has been killed, it starts to look like the system, the investigation system and the prosecution system, are actually treating them as privileged members of society. And I just don't think that's correct.
Well, clearly, in the speech that Hillary Clinton made today at Columbia University, calling for an end to the era of mass incarceration, I think you could add to that perhaps an end to the failed war on drugs. I mean, isn't that at the heart of so much of this disparity in the population of men versus women in Sandtown, where Freddie Gray was from and where his spine was snapped in police custody? I mean, that seems to me, I mean, one of the things that I find so frustrating is the way that the media, and particularly cable television, have covered this. First of all, they didn't even cover the peaceful protests for days. They only sort of paid any attention when the CVS got looted and some buildings caught on fire, and running around calling everybody thugs, et cetera. I mean, it's depressing to be in the media and to look at this superficial coverage.
Yeah, I think that it is. I understand the challenge for anybody who's, you know, dropping in on the problems in Baltimore to decide where exactly to start the story. Meaning, you can start the story with Freddie Gray, and we can talk about what's happening in the streets of Baltimore, and you can bring your own biases and opinions to the conduct that you're observing. You could go back a couple of years and you could start the story with Tyrone West, who died while he was in police custody. You could start the story back a little further and you could pick another person, you know, another citizen who was killed by a police officer or died in custody. You could go back even further and you could examine the education system and where the breakdown is. And you could certainly drop in, as you suggested, a critical juncture, which is, you know, new mandatory minimums in drug trafficking cases in the late 1980s and the abolition of parole in the federal prison system in the late 1980s. And we could look at how long people have been in prison and what happens when they're being returned to prison. I teach criminal law and constitutional criminal procedure, and I teach those classes very much through a lens of what we think of as the war on drugs and what the agenda would be of a police officer whose primary goal was to be investigating or trying to stop in its tracks the drug dealing business, the drug importation business, and how that's a very different goal and tactic and method of policing than would be employed if the overall agenda was to make sure that a automobile was never stolen again, or that there was never another burglary, or whatever priority you might want to put first. There's no doubt when you look at police statistics, and I just looked at them this week for Fairfax County, Virginia, that, you know, the majority of resources and the majority of crime that takes up time in police departments is going to be related to narcotics and not other kinds of crimes where we can identify a specific victim.
But obviously, semantically, it's not a very smart move to talk about legalizing drugs, but it does make sense to medicalize, since clearly nobody looks into the psychological reasons why people take drugs. But what we do know about the so-called war on drugs is that the illicit sale of drugs generates enormous amounts of money and has led to this prison industrial complexing and the warehousing of young men. And the real question is, you know, could you get rid of this problem in a simple medical way, as opposed to this incredibly expensive and counterintuitive and counterproductive way?
Yeah, I think there are certainly scholars who address that and who do very good work and good studies on cause and effect and how taking narcotics out of the criminal justice system may reduce overall crime rates. I don't think there is a single thing to quote unquote fix it. You know, when I hear you quoting Hillary Clinton, I'm very glad that at a national level, politicians are thinking about these problems and issues. But these are problems that didn't just crop up today. They've been there for 40, 50 years, and we can certainly go back a lot further than that if we want to go back to talking about slave patrols. But these are long-standing problems. These are problems of economic depression. These are problems of education. These are problems of availability of work and resources that are available and how tax dollars are spent and who gets the most tax dollars spent at individual schools and how do you do remedial, how do you undertake remedial measures to try to help populations catch up to whatever we think of as the norm. I like that a lot of people think about it from a lot of different perspectives, and I think the role of a good politician is to take that information and, you know, do resource allocation and decide how to begin to be strategic in thinking about turning this very big ship around and maybe putting it back on a better track.
But Amy Dillard, in terms of the interaction between citizens and police, and particularly in Sandtown, it's extraordinary to think that this young man, Freddie Gray, had his spine snapped in police custody, screaming in pain. And the reason he was arrested was that he made eye contact with a lieutenant in the Baltimore police. I mean, what kind of a crime is making eye contact?
Yeah, I've talked about this a good bit, particularly this year in the class that I teach. So, you know, when we go back and we look at the U.S. Constitution, we see that, you know, police shouldn't seize a person unless they have probable cause to do so. And then in 1967, 68, the Supreme Court lowered that standard and said that police officers were constitutional if they engaged in a brief detention with the citizen, and they didn't have to have probable cause. They just had to have reasonable, articulable suspicion that criminal activity was afoot. I don't know what criminal activity they thought he was engaged in when he did that. There's certainly no such thing as felonious running, but running in addition to other factors, could be, you know, a reasonable, articulable suspicion that there's criminal activity afoot from the point of view of a trained police officer. We just haven't heard what that is.
Well, but just in closing, though, the Baltimore Sun's investigation, and we mentioned how much money's been paid out, and there have been more than 100 people have won court judgments or settlements from the city for police brutality. And the victims include a 15-year-old boy riding a dirt bike, a 26-year-old pregnant woman who had witnessed a beating, a 50-year-old woman selling church raffle tickets, a 65-year-old church deacon, and an 87-year-old grandmother aiding her wounded grandson. So it doesn't sound like, I mean, obviously those are cherry-picked statistics, but right. On the other hand, you know, the police surely have better things to do and more dangerous criminals out there.
You know, it's interesting to me that it is that broad array. We could see it in a couple of ways. One, those represent the most outrageous cases, the ones that the city has decided to settle and is not fighting about, and it makes you wonder how many other cases have been brought that haven't been settled in that way or didn't make it into this story, you know, or where there was an allegation of brutality, but it just wasn't quite enough evidence to prove it because maybe the only witness was the officer who's being accused of the brutality and the citizen who, you know, was on the receiving end of that brutality. So it's just worth recognizing that just because those cases have reached a settlement, that just means those are the best of the best in terms of being able to prove them from the citizen's point of view. The second thing I'll say is that it doesn't surprise me when police officers are trained to investigate and watch for criminal activity that's relating to narcotics, that they begin to see everyone in the community as other, everyone as a part of that system of narcotics distribution. So from the 80-plus-year-old grandmother to the 15-year-old to the pregnant woman, that you look out and you see every person and you think everyone I'm looking at could be involved in drug transactions. It's almost like, you know, I imagine a soldier looking out and saying, oh, every person that I'm looking at could be the enemy. And we've certainly seen enough movies about Vietnam, Afghanistan, to see that that begins to happen. There's a good bit that's been written about how police departments have been militarized and how many recruits have military service. And, you know, I think it's worth the people who study that psychological effect on people to think about how that's seeping into law enforcement.
Well, Amy Dillon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Happy to, Ian. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Amy Dillard, who's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and a former public defender. She recently served on a Baltimore commission to examine the death of a prisoner in police custody. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the only person to be punished so far for the Bush-Cheney CIA torture regime. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ali Watkins, a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for the Huffington Post and previously covered national security and regional politics for McClatchy Newspapers' D.C. Bureau. Her latest article at the Huffington Post is "Someone is Finally Paying the Price for the CIA Torture Report." Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Watkins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And it is extraordinary to think that 6 months after this report finally got released, the 6,900 pages eventually, it had been in the sausage-making process in secret for years, and the CIA fought it tooth and nail, they redacted it, et cetera, and it finally comes out, and nothing is done in terms of the revelations about the perpetrators of this disastrous policy. And certainly the intellectual architects at the highest political level got off scot-free. But now we find, thanks to your reporting, that Alyssa Starczyk, the Obama administration's nominee for Army General Counsel, is being punished because she was a lead investigator for the torture report.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating and I think fairly disturbing story. To see this stark contrast, you know, as you said, it's been about 8 years now since, you know, the CIA quote-unquote detention and interrogation slash torture program officially ended. And we've seen little to no accountability on that end. You know, none of the torturers have been held accountable. None of their superiors at the agency were held accountable. And even throughout the course of this torture report drama, you know, we had a whole incident with the CIA improperly snooping into the computers that were used to construct this study, Senate computers, and what Senator Dianne Feinstein, Intelligence Committee Vice Chair, now called a constitutional crisis. And to see the lack of accountability for those actions, and then to stack that against, you know, the fact that the people who worked to expose these wrongs, to expose the CIA's abuses, like Alyssa Starczyk, this Obama administration nominee, it's staggering to look at the contrast here.
So do you think, though, that the fact that Dianne Feinstein went public and she was clearly angry when she made that statement about this constitutional crisis, did she not mention Alyssa's name and the other staffer's name? In other words, did that put a target on their back?
Yes. So that's actually a very interesting question. It's something that a lot of people have kind of hypothesized as this has gone on. So when Senator Feinstein first, announced that the report was coming out, she gave a personal thank you to Alyssa Starczak and Alyssa Starczak's colleague, Dan Jones, who helped lead the report team, too. For the agency, it may have put a target on their back, kind of pointing them out like that. On the other side of the coin, the people who've really hailed their efforts, I think, really felt that they deserve the recognition. So I think it's really the lines are kind of drawn here. The supporters of this report, Democrats, a lot of the CIA's critics have really supported and endorsed these staffers who worked on this report for so long and feel that they deserve credit, and they do, for working so long and so hard to expose these things. But like you said, flip side, it also puts a target on their back for all of their critics who now hold the reins of the majority in the Senate.
So, but in terms of the CIA itself, there have been divisions within the agency, and I think a lot of this stuff came out in these reports, and particularly the key part, which is called the Panetta Review, the document that the CIA was snooping on the Senate committees to find out what they had. That seems to be also a part of the story. I mean, there are many layers to this story, but, if you talk to people like Glenn Carl, who was in the CIA, wrote a book about his torture experiences. There are people in the agency who thought the whole thing was ridiculous and counterproductive from the beginning. He had supposedly the number three guy in Al-Qaeda in one of these black sites, and he kept telling headquarters, you got the wrong guy. And they said, oh, he's just clever and he's dissembling, so you have to torture him more. And then you've got Rodriguez and these other guys who came in, the sort of like the macho guys from Latin America who are used to pulling fingernails, and they sort of took over. They purged all the Arabic speakers, which is insane, but that's what they did. Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't there something to that? And where does Brennan stand in the division between the more professional officers and the swashbucklers?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you hit it right on the head where you talk about there's this multi-layered torture issue. I mean, it's an incredibly complicated story. But just, solely taking the issue of torture and looking at the agency, the torture report lays that out, and the CIA's own statements have kind of laid it out. Within the agency, there were lots of divisions over, whether this was a good idea. And as you said, people on the ground, CIA officers on the ground, passing up to headquarters, we shouldn't be doing this to these people. They don't know anything else. It's the wrong people. But then you have the incredibly powerful official machine of the agency that to this day still refuses to characterize what happened as torture. John Brennan, even after this report came out last December, 2 days later, John Brennan still refused to call it torture. So you do have this kind of, as you said, Glenn Carl, people within the agency who were saying this is a bad idea, but they really can't do anything when the official line of the agency and those in the seventh floor executive offices say that it should be happening. As far as where John Brennan falls down on it, he's kind of a mystery wrapped in an enigma in many, many regards. But specifically when it comes to torture, it's almost like he's Teflon. Nothing really sticks to this guy. He was very high up in the agency as this was happening. I believe it was 02 to 04 or so. He was second or third in command He was very involved in the executive side of the agency. And at his confirmation hearing with the Senate to become CIA director about 2-3 years ago, he was asked, specifically, were you involved in the torture program? What were your feelings on this? And he has consistently said that, he did not endorse it. He kind of towed this very careful middle line. And many people who know Brennan, who work with Brennan, say that that's how he's been able to advance so far in his career, is because he has towed that middle line and he's done the same with torture.
Well, but he lied to the public about the CIA's involvement in snooping on the Senate Intelligence Committee's computers and didn't...
Unfortunately, not if you ask the CIA, because the CIA cleared itself of snooping. So you're of course...
I thought he had to reverse himself, didn't he?
He reversed himself and then re-reversed himself. after the agency's internal accountability board said that that really wasn't that bad. Like, it wasn't, you know, it was unintentional. It's been a very strange back and forth for John Brennan, but somehow the White House is still not willing to hold anyone accountable.
Well, he's very close to Obama, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Very close to Obama and Dennis McDonough.
Yeah.
You know, he's had a long history with that administration and with a lot of powerful people high up in it.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Watkins, who's a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for Huffington Post and previously covered national security and regional politics for McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau. Her latest article at the Huffington Post is Someone is Finally Paying the Price for the CIA Torture Report. And the someone is Alyssa Starczak, who's the Obama administration's nominee for Army General Counsel. She's actually being held up. She was originally approved on a voice vote when the Democrats controlled the Senate, but now she's back with the same committee, Armed Services, and John McCain is holding up hers and other nominees as well for reasons of his own, which we can certainly get into. But at the end of the day, the person who really is spearheading the effort to scuttle her is the Intelligence Committee Chairman Richard Burr. And he's apparently defending the people at the CIA, you know, the Rodriguez clique. So walk us through the politics here, if you will, Ali.
It's quite a complicated political game. You know, Richard Burr obviously was, he was not even vice chair last year. He took over for retiring Saxby Chambliss and then took on the Intelligence Committee chairmanship when Republicans took the Senate this January. You know, as far as politics go, Richard Burr has always stood behind the agency's interrogation program. He has defended the use of the techniques, and he's been a consistent critic of the Senator Feinstein's torture report. And not only has he been a critic of the report itself, he's been a fierce critic of the Democratic staff who helped construct the report. When the report's executive summary was released in December, Senator Burr and a handful of his other Republican colleagues released their own rebuttal to the Senate torture report, and they dedicated a pretty hefty amount of ink to slamming Democratic staff specifically for their actions in accessing these internal documents of the Panetta Review, for taking the Panetta Review. So as far as politics go, you know, it's a pretty cut and dry, you know, that there are people who have seriously disapproved of the Democratic staff actions are now in positions of a lot of power, you know, when it comes to Obama administration nominees, when it comes to the dynamics of the Intelligence Committee. And Alyssa Starczak has, unfortunately for her, become the first real casualty of that.
Yeah, but this turns the whole idea of what our legislatures are supposed to be. They're supposed to be the advocates of the citizens, and they're supposed to be the ones that keep the government in check. And they're not supposed to be the apologists and help government cover up what it's doing. That's what I find extraordinary, that somehow, you know, it's okay for these Republicans to be champions of covering up CIA secrets and then to trash, you know, Feinstein for doing her job, which is what is the same job that they should be doing. Because as far as I know, the actual content of the Panetta Review that's at issue here is not about exposing CIA sources and methods. It's about how this train wreck of a torture regime was started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Panetta Review is, you know, not touching on sources and methods. At least that's not what Democratic staff says was really important about it. You know, it exemplifies how the agency lied, the agency mismanaged, the agency abused this torture program. And it, you know, this, I think this kind of, this whole story, as you mentioned, kind of hits it. You know, what is with this skewed definition of oversight? You know, when you really think about what does it mean to oversee the intelligence community, that's such a small window. And as opposed to, you know, so many other arms of Washington, you know, the Pentagon, the judicial system, you know, those are all overt systems that are semi in the public sunlight. But the intelligence community is just behind this almost impenetrable shield. And the public really has to rely on the intelligence committees as one of their only ways of having a check on that community. And when you kind of look at what this Starzec situation, what the Panetta review situation, what the torture report situation says about the Intelligence Committee's differing definitions of oversight, it really is of concern. You know, when is there such a thing as selective oversight? You know, should the intelligence agencies get to decide the committees can have access to the Panetta review or they can't have access to the Panetta review? You know, does that cut at the core of what good oversight is supposed to be? So when you talk about how that's kind of undermining the whole purpose of, you know, the voice of the people, I don't think you could be more on point with that. It really, as I said, hits at the definition of what oversight is supposed to be.
Well, you know, one understands that the CIA, with its culture of secrecy, doesn't like the idea of the committees. And I think from the very beginning, they used to refer to the oversight committees as the mushroom farm. We keep them in the dark, and every now and then we throw manure on them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using a more polite word. But what about McCain? What's he doing with all these nominees that he's holding up, including Alyssa Starzec?
So that's kind of just another separate game of political politics that's being played for completely unrelated reasons, anything related to the torture report. Senator McCain is just slow walking several civilian nominees that come through his committee. I believe it's in kind of to get back at Democrats for kind of trying to push so many nominees through in the midnight hour. From what I understand, you know, in the 11th hour of the Democratic Congress, you know, last December, there was kind of this tidal wave of nominees that went through the Senate floor, just because they were trying to get as many through as possible while they had a Democratic majority. And to retaliate for that, you know, Senator McCain's now slow walking several civilian positions that are supposed to come through his committee. So completely unrelated to the torture report issues. But, you know, as we mentioned in the story, even once Starzec can get over that political hurdle, she's got quite a big one waiting for her in this Intelligence Committee battle.
Well, Ali Watkins, let's stay in touch, because this story deserves a lot of attention. And it is extraordinary that nobody's ever paid a price for the enormous black eye that the United States has taken internationally for this torture regime that everybody acknowledges didn't work, didn't yield anything except international embarrassment.
Thanks for having me, Ian. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Ali Watkins, who is a Washington, D.C.-based journalist who covers national security and foreign policy for the Huffington Post and previously covered national security and regional politics for McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau. Her latest article at the Huffington Post is "Someone is Finally Paying the Price for the CIA Torture Report." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.